everybody.
So we were in the process of formulating a Hamiltonian formulation of general relativity. And as I told you last time, one necessary step to do that is to decompose space-time into space and time. And that's done by foliating the space-time manifold into a stack of space-like hypersurfaces. And we need to do that because in order to identify the conjugate momentum to the field variable, you need to define a time derivative. And that can only be done if you can distinguish what is time from what is space. And that's where the 3 plus 1 decomposition comes in. So what I'll do here is to just complete that, decomposition that we had started last time. Then what I'll do is to construct a Hamiltonian for a scalar field theory. And then we'll go into the much more detailed work that needs to go into the formulation of Hamiltonian for general relativity itself. And there's a lot of details that go into that. We have all the tools that we need in order to achieve this, but there's a lot of detailed work that needs to be done along the way, and I'll just need to spend some time doing all of that. Okay, so let's go back to the 3 plus 1 decomposition. So mostly I'm going to recap what we had talked about last time. So we have space-time, and we have the foliation of space-time into a stack of space-like hypersurfaces. Each one will represent a moment in time. And each hypersurface is called the leaf of the foliation. There's a nice floral language that people use in this context. We've defined a time function, which will be a scalar field of the space-time manifold expressed in terms of the original coordinate system that we would have placed on our manifold. So x alpha would be the original coordinates. T is a scalar field on that. And it's a time function in the sense that, well, it's the defining relation for each one of those space-like hypersurfaces. So this would be a surface t equals t1, this would be a surface t equals t2, and this would be a surface t equals t3, and all of that. So each of those hypersurfaces is a surface of constant t, t being that scalar field that I'm talking about here. So t plays the role of phi, and phi as a function of the space-time coordinates being equal to a constant is, one of the defining relations for each one of the hypersurfaces. So we did that. We placed the coordinate system on our space-like hypersurfaces, and we connected the coordinates on this surface to the coordinates on that surface to the coordinates on this surface by a network of curves, a congruence of curves. So we have the space-time, so we have the surfaces, and then we have the curves, which are completely arbitrary curves. The only requirement is that they don't intersect, so they form a proper confluence of curves. But there's no requirement that those curves be geodesics, and there's no requirement that the intersection between the curves and the surfaces be orthogonal. We want to have complete freedom in that. But the point is that each curve, so if I set up, a coordinate system such that this point is coordinates YA, then the curves essentially tell us that, well, if this point has coordinates YA, this point will have exactly the same coordinate, this point will have exactly the same coordinates, and so on and so forth. So those curves produce a mapping from a coordinate system on one hypersurface to a coordinate system on each of the members, on each member of the foliation. So those curves are curves of constant, spatial coordinates YA, and we choose to parameterize each curve by the time function T. So T is a parameter along each curve. So that's the basic construction, and we extracted a number of consequences from all of this. We have a tangent vector on the curves. Which I'm denoting T alpha, and which is defined in this case to be the derivative of the coordinates with respect to the parameter T, keeping YA fixed. So the point of view here is that we have a relationship given by the construction between the original four nets and, well, the new ones that we might be using to describe the space-time. The new coordinates are obtained from the construction that we just give here, and the, you know, the basic idea here is that there's a relationship between the new coordinate system and the old one. And if I take, you know, if I look at this equation and I say what happens when I take the partial derivative of the coordinates with respect to t and I keep y a constant, well, geometrically it's very clear what's going on. We're displacing ourselves along each one of those curves, and therefore this quantity has to be the tangent vector on the curve. And we have also tangent vectors on the hypersurfaces. And each one I'll call sigma t. And those are defined in the usual way by taking partial derivatives of the coordinates with respect to the spatial coordinates, keeping t fixed this time. Because here we're, you know, we're considering displacements on the hypersurface as opposed to off the hypersurface. So we have this vector, we have those vectors, we also have normal vector, which is defined up to a normalization factor as the gradient of the time function t. And the last thing that we did last time was to actually introduce a decomposition of the tangent vector, which I'll call the flow vector, into a basis that will be formed from the tangent vectors on the hypersurface and the normal vector off the hypersurface. So here we have, so this is a vector that's orthogonal to each one of those. We have a good vectorial basis. If we combine those three vectors with that normal vector, we can decompose vectors and tensors in that basis. And in particular, we can decompose this vector, the flow vector, into the vectorial basis, and that gives us the expression for the normal vector that says, for the flow vector, that says that there's a component along the normal, but then there's also a tangential component like this. And here we have introduced some of the major, you know, important quantities that are involved in the Hamiltonian formulation, the lapse and the shift. So if the lapse is a scalar, it fixes the normalization of the normal vector. The shift, well, is just defined, you know, in terms of this equation, you know, they are the components of the flow vector in the tangential directions. So, you know, if we had fixed the curves to be orthogonal to the hypersurfaces, there would be no shift, and that would be, you know, a possible choice. The point is that we don't want to make this choice. We want to leave, we want to keep things general, and therefore the decomposition has to be general. It has to involve four different quantities, three quantities into the shift and one quantity into the lapse. So that's the, well, that's the construction. That's the geometric constructions associated with the 3 plus 1 decomposition. And what we can do from here is to extract some of its consequences. And then we'll use that in, well, later calculations. So let's see. So one thing that I can do is to express the metric in terms of the new coordinates. So the idea that I introduced is that, well, we have a space-time manifold, which, you know, which is given, you know, on which we put an original coordinate system. Those are the x alphas that I'm talking about. But then with the help of this construction, we get a new coordinate system, one that's adapted to the foveation. We have y a coordinates on each curve surface, and we have the time function. And t n y a is a new coordinate system that, as I expressed mathematically up there, is in relation to the old coordinate system. So if we're given the metric in the old coordinate system, we can do the coordinate transformation and get the metric in the new coordinate system. And that's what I want to do now. I want to express the metric in terms of the new TYA coordinates. And while the procedure is very simple, we just carry out the coordinate transformation. So what I want to do here is to construct the metric of space-time in the new coordinates. The new coordinates are T and Y A. And well, what we do is to just write down an expression for d alpha that is going to be expressed in terms of t and ya. And well, it's the usual thing. We just write down this identity for the differential. And then we recognize that, well, the first partial derivative is actually the definition for the vector t alpha, the flow vector. And those partial derivatives are just the definition for the tangential vector. And what we can do here is to plug in our decomposition for the flow vector in terms of the normal and the tangential vectors. And what we have then is, well, this expression, n alpha plus na. E alpha a multiplying dt plus e alpha a multiplying dya. And then I can group things together, and I'll have one component along the normal, which is n dt along the normal vector. And then I have tangential components, which are going to be na dt plus dya. And while that is the step where you you do the Porter transformation, and you express the old differentials in terms of new differentials, and then we just need to plug that into the expression for the line element, and we have our metric. So d s squared is g alpha beta dx alpha dx beta, so that's the line element expressed in the old coordinates. We're going to make the substitution, express d alpha in this form. And express d beta in the same form. So here I have to distinguish the indices, so I'll use the b index that will multiply e beta b. And we just multiply things together, but the multiplication is actually pretty simple because we have orthogonal pieces here. So there won't be any cross terms because the inner product between m and e is zero. So we get, you know, a piece quadratic in this and another piece quadratic in that. So what do we have? Well, we have n squared dt squared that multiply the inner product of n with itself. And n is a unit time-like vector, so we get minus one from that. That's the first term in the metric. And the second term in the metric will involve the product of this times that times the metric. So we're going to have the inner product of the vector EA with the vector EB. And this, you'll remember, is the induced metric on the hypersurface. So when you work it out, you get an HAB from the inner product of the two basis vectors. And then you multiply this with the rest of it. And that's our expression for the metric in terms of the new coordinates, t and y. And the, you know, the 10 components of the metric have been decomposed into 6 components that appear in the induced metric. So that's going to be the purely spatial metric on each one of the hypersurfaces. We have 6 here, we have 3 here in the lattice, and we have 1 more in the shift, and we have 1 more in the lattice. So we have 6 plus 3 plus 1, and we have the required 10 metric components. And the reason why we didn't want to restrict our freedom in choosing the curves is the fact that, well, we didn't want to get rid of the shift in the construction by, you know, demanding that the curves be orthogonal. And if we had done that, we would have had serious restriction on the coordinate system that would have killed 3 of the metric components. And the point is that we don't want to do that. If we were to do that, it would restrict the general covariance of the whole approach. Here, we sort of made the general covariance less obvious as before because we have explicit 3 plus 1 decomposition of everything, but we retain all of the freedom. And the original freedom of choosing the coordinates is, in fact, captured by the total freedom we have specifying the shift on each hypersurface and specifying the lapse on each surface. Those are the quantities that tell us how we're supposed to move from one hypersurface to another. And we also have, of course, complete freedom in choosing the YA coordinate. So once you've made a selection on one hypersurface, you have complete freedom in doing that. And then you have complete freedom in moving that information toward the future and the past. So all of the original port freedom is there, all of the original general covariance is there. Now it's packaged differently in a way that now makes it obvious that you're working in 3 plus 1, you know, language. So that's the expression for the metric. So, so we have, the space-space components are all contained here. The space-time components are contained in the induced metric and lapse vector. And then the time-time component is contained in the lapse and also in the square of the shift. So if you bring all the terms together that that are in front of dt squared, you'll get this combination. You'll get this term, but you'll also get something that involves the square of the shift vector. So, you can read off from this all the components, all the explicit components of the metric in the coordinate system, and of course, all of the functions that appear here, the 3 metric, the shift, and the lapse are all functions of T and YA. Or you can think of them as, functions in the original coordinate system. I don't really care to distinguish here, so we don't have to commit ourselves to this coordinate system. We can still think of working in the original coordinates if we wish. There's really no obstacle in keeping the dual picture, active as we keep going. One consequence of having written the metric in this coordinate system is the fact that the volume element in that coordinate system can be worked out. You can actually express the determinant of the 4-dimensional metric in terms of the quantities that we have here. I do that in the notes. It requires almost no work if you think of involving the inverse metric to do that. But what you find is that the volume element in this coordinate system becomes, the determinant of the metric, the square root, becomes a factor of lapse and a spatial determinant, the determinant of the spatial metric. And that will multiply V3Y, and that will multiply dt. And the interpretation here, I think, is obvious. N dt is an integral of prop time as you move off the hypersurface. And square root of H d3y is a volume, is a 3-dimensional volume element. And the connection between prop time and so the fact that the lapse is involved so the connection between a time interval. So if you pick the displacement, so that's the volume element, and I think it has a compelling interpretation in terms of increments in proper time and purely volume elements. And that's the result we're going to be using. And again, I won't derive it here, but it's very straightforward, and you can get the derivation from the notes. Okay, so that's the geometric construction. That's the 3 plus 1 decomposition of space-time into a stack of space-like type surfaces. And that's the starting point for our Hamiltonian formulation. And what I'll do now is to just tell you what you need to do to get the Hamiltonian of the field theory, scalar field theory. And then we'll deal with the real job and do it for general relativity. Before I turn to general relativity, I'll have to do a lot more of this sort of thing to take care of the boundary. And that has to do with the fact that the action for gravity has this boundary term, and all we've talked about here is the foliation of the ball. I need to also tell you something about the foliation of the boundary. and that requires a lot of little detailed work that's more or less all along those lines, and along lines that we've talked about before. But there's a lot of detailed work that needs to go into that. Okay, so let's talk about a scalar field theory. So we already know, how to get, how to formulate the Lagrangian, formulation for a scalar field theory. And we know that our Lagrangian will depend on field variables Q on their derivatives. And also it will depend on the metric, but here I don't really, I don't really need to indicate that explicitly. If you think about mechanics, you know that when you want to, go from the Lagrangian to the Hamiltonian, the first thing you need to do is to define a conjugate momentum. And conjugate momentum is the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the time derivative of, the generalized velocities that appear in the Lagrangian. If we want to do this for field theory, what we have to do is to define a canonical momentum associated with field variable in terms of the derivative. In terms of the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the time derivative of field. I'm not sure if I said that correctly. So in order to define the canonical momentum associated with field variable, you have to differentiate the Lagrangian with respect to the time derivative of the field. And what that means is that you have to define what is time and distinguish it from what is space, and that's what we've done before. And now what I have to do is to introduce a notion of a time derivative for my field variables. And then I can go and rewrite down the Lagrangian density in terms of this time derivative and the spatial derivatives. I can distinguish what's what. And then I can differentiate purely with the time derivatives and then construct my P. And then once I have P, I can build Hamiltonian. So those are steps that are all required. So, of space-time derivatives of the field, we need to distinguish what is time and what is space derivatives. Well, we have all of the proper ingredients here, and essentially there are two notions of time derivatives that offer themselves from the construction. One would be, let's take derivatives in the normal direction to each hypersurface. And the other one would be, let's take derivatives along the direction of the flow vectors. And I'm not sure to what extent you would be successful at pushing the first option. We're going to be pushing the second option. We're going to define our time derivatives to be derivatives along the direction of vector t. That's the definition. Q dot, by definition, is going to be the derivative of the scalar field Q in the direction of the t vector. So it's a derivative along the curves that define the flow off of each hypersurface. Given, there's a lot of stuff that goes into that. I mean, in order to define the time derivative, the first thing, so the notion of time derivative here involves all of the details of that construction. You need to specify the foliation to begin with. And even if you have the foliation, in order to define the flow, you still need to introduce those curves. So you really need the foliation plus the curves. Or another way of saying this is that in order to define the time derivative, you need the foliation and you need the specification for the lapse and shift, because it's only, so the foliation tells you what the normal vector is and what the tangential vectors are. The flow vector is obtained only after, on top of all this, you specify the lapse and the shift. All of those ingredients are required before you can even define that thing. And the Hamiltonian is going to be contingent on all of these things. So all of those choices have to be specified before you can say for sure what the Hamiltonian actually is. And in particular, the Hamiltonian will be, will be dependent on foliation. The Hamiltonian will also be dependent on the choices that you made for the lapse and the shift. That's very essential. It's all part of what is involved in Hamiltonian formulation. So we have the spatial, the time derivatives defined in this way with all the, you know, all of the baggage that the foveation comes with. And of course, we're going to also, well, we're going to distinguish that from the spatial derivatives. And I'll just indicate the spatial derivatives with an index A without comma or without, you know, any other notation. And spatial derivatives, of course, are going to be, well, derivatives purely in the direction of the hypersurfaces. So it's going to be the tangential components of the field derivatives. And once we have that, of course, we can decompose, you know, Q alpha, the derivative of Q, in terms of Q dot QA. And what we can do at this stage is to rewrite the Lagrangian density in terms of Q, in terms of its time derivative, in terms of its spatial derivatives. And once you have that, you have the possibility of differentiating the Lagrangian with respect to Q dot, and have the possibility of defining a canonical momentum. The canonical momentum, called P, it's a field momentum, and it's going to be defined in terms of the Q dot derivative of the Lagrangian. But here there's an interesting twist. We throw in a factor of root G here. Why? Because that's how it's done. The Hamiltonian and the canonical momentum are defined as densities, not as scalar quantities. When I first encountered that, I was uncomfortable, and I thought maybe it, you know, maybe it doesn't need to be done like that. Maybe it could be done by not throwing in the factor of root G, and maybe you could define P as a scalar quantity, and maybe you could define a Hamiltonian as a scalar quantity, and maybe you could just, you know, as a different convention, choose to pursue that approach. And that's right. And somehow something goes wrong somewhere, and I could never quite figure out why it goes wrong, and I just failed my attempt to reformulate the entire Hamiltonian formulation of general relativity in terms of scalar quantities. And I cannot believe that there's something fundamental about this. I think something like that could be done. But the point is that historically, and also in the literature, and, you know, the way it's always been done is by throwing in this factor of root G and agreeing by convention that all of our Hamiltonian quantities are going to be density quantities. Density quantities as opposed to scalar quantities, the difference between between a density and a scalar is that, well, we have factors of root G that float into quantities that prevent them from being true scalars. That's the way it's done. We're going to do it like that because everybody else is doing like that, and I wasn't clever enough to do it differently. Okay, so that's our convention. So we're going to find P, the canonical momentum associated with the field variables, to be the Q dot derivative of not just the Lagrangian density, but the Lagrangian density, including the factor of root G that appears, of course, in the integral of the action. And of course, you know, given that we start with the Lagrangian density, what we're talking about here is a momentum density. And the total momentum of the field would be the integral of this over a space, a spatial hypersurface. Okay, so that's the, yep.
The fact that it's a scalar density, because you've been integrated.
Right, so when you integrate over a space-like surface, you would like to involve root H. Your bottom element. The difference between root G and root H is a factor of M,
right,
which is scalar. So if I had removed the root G from here and decided to insert it in the measure, I would essentially do exactly the same thing except for floating factors of M that I could choose to absorb or whatever. So I think, I mean, again, my feeling is that there's probably ways of doing this with a different convention, but somehow I didn't manage to pull it off. I gave up.
Did I answer your question? Okay, so now that we have P and so we have the Lagrange, we have a good definition for the canonical momentum. The way to define the Hamiltonian, well, it's essentially exactly the same, the same route that you would follow in mechanics. We're going to define first a Hamiltonian density. Which I'll call curly H. And curly H, well, it's going to be the usual PQ dot minus L thing, except that, of course, we have to keep carrying that extra factor of G that was there over here and needs to be over here as well. So that's the definition for that Hamiltonian density. Of course, here it's understood that you're going to solve for Q dot in terms of P and spatial derivatives, so that what you get at the end is function of Q, P, and QA. So you eliminate Q dot from your list of phase space variables. That's the Hamiltonian density, and then the full Hamiltonian is going to be the integral of that. It's going to be the spatial integral of Hamiltonian density. And here we don't incorporate a factor of root H in the measure because it's already implicitly placed here. So we integrate density over the Hamiltonian density over the coordinate volume element. And we know that we don't have to insert the root H here because it's already incorporated in the other definitions. Yep.
With the nomenclature, when you call that H the Hamiltonian density, and last term, last week, we defined script L as the Lagrangian density, not script L G, the Lagrangian density.
Right.
But would it be more appropriate to call the combination of L and determinant of G the Lagrangian density?
Well, you have two notions of density, one that refers to coordinate volume, one that refers to invariant volume,
okay,
and I didn't distinguish them, so, but I don't think it's a big deal. Okay, and then the Hamiltonian then is going to be a function
of field configuration and the momentum configuration on each hypersurface. So it becomes functional because, functional is a function of a function. So in order to evaluate this, we need to specify the field configuration and the momentum configuration on each hypersurface. After you've selected the configurations, you can actually integrate. And you produce a number. That number is the Hamiltonian for that field configuration. Therefore, the Hamiltonian is a function of functions, a function of field configurations, and that makes it a functional of Q and P on each hypersurface. And you have to think of the Hamiltonian as something that lives on each hypersurface. You have one Hamiltonian for each hypersurface. In other words, the Hamiltonian is itself a function of time. And you get a different value for the Hamiltonian depending on which hypersurface you select. That's the Hamiltonian being a function of time. Okay. I want to see this further here. In the notes, what I do is to go through, a derivation of the Hamilton equations for the field. And the way you would do that is, the way you would do it in mechanics. You can rewrite the action in terms of the Hamiltonian. You can vary the action with respect to field and momentum variables. You can, you have variations delta Q, you have variations delta P. You demand that the variations delta Q vanish from the boundary. You place no restrictions on the variations of the momenta. You do the variational principle, and you treat dq independently from dp, and you do all the detailed work that goes into that, and in the end, you end up with two sets of equations that are called Hamilton's equations. One tells you what q dot is going to be doing, and the other one tells you what p dot is going to be doing, and you have field equations in Hamilton form, and field equations that do rely on all of the aspects of the decomposition that we have here. So field equations that involve the lapse and the shift and this particular position of space-time into space and time. So, I mean, you know, it's pretty straightforward to go through all of that, and I do all of that in detail in the notes. I don't wish to do it here because when I deal with gravity, what I'm going to be mostly interested in is the actual construction of the Hamiltonian, how to vary the Hamiltonian, how to go through all the steps varying the gravitational action to end up with the field equations written in 3 plus 1 form is something that I also carry out in the book. It requires endless calculations. It's very tedious to go through that. I'm not going to do that in class, but what I'll put instead is to look at the Hamiltonian and see what can tell us about conserved quantities and quantities that can characterize an asymptotically flat space-time. And I'll establish a connection between the gravitational Hamiltonian and mass and angular momentum. And all I need in order to do all of that is to use the Hamiltonian as such and not necessarily to involve it in Hamilton's equations. So I'll cut the story short here. I'll proceed with the gravitational Hamiltonian, and there's a lot of good stuff that I will talk about because it just would take too much time. So, I'll leave that for you to explore on your own if you wish. So what I want to do, so essentially the point of doing all of this is to show what needs to be done in order to define canonical momenta and Hamiltonians in a field theory. When it's time to do it for gravity, of course, we're going to do exactly the same thing. We're going to have Lagrangian density for gravity. We're going to be able to define, a canonical momentum associated with the gravitational field, which will define the notion of H dot. We'll define a canonical momentum P associated with the gravitational field, and we'll construct the Hamiltonian by following exactly the same recipe. One difference here is that, for a scalar field theory, you only have to deal with an action which is pure bulk. So it's for a scalar field theory, the action is expressed as bulk integral of the Lagrangian density, and you don't have boundary term. When you do it for gravity, you have bulk term, but we also have boundary term, which we know is important. And what we'll have to do is to treat the boundary term very carefully. And in particular, the first thing we need to do is to think of not only foliating the bulk in terms of space-like outer surfaces, but also foliating the boundary in terms of boundary surfaces. So that's what I was talking about before, and I need to go through some of that, before we reface the issue of constructing the gravitational Hamiltonian. And as I said before, there's a lot of detailed things. I mean, I'll introduce a multitude of notation to deal with all the aspects that are relevant to the problem. It's going to be always the same thing, and it's going to be stuff that we've done before, so there's nothing particularly difficult about it, but we're going to have to keep track of all the notation that I introduce, and I'll fetch it. Maybe write a little bit smaller on the board so that we can keep a record of all the relevant equations and use them where it's appropriate. So before I get into that, any questions about anything here? Okay, so let's get going. All right, so I think I'll leave this picture on, and then I'll make some room for the rest. So what we want to do is to consider a finite domain V of our manifold, and we want to foliate that, and we want to foliate the boundary as well. So let me draw a picture for this. So my domain V, I'm going to take it to be truncated by two of our space-like hypersurfaces. So there's going to be a segment of that hypersurface over here. Let's call it sigma 2. So this is the surface T equals T2. And it's going to be truncated by some kind of finite spatial domain, and then it's going to truncate below by another of our tangible constant hypersurfaces, this one I'll call sigma 1, and that's t equals t1. And so this is our domain V. We have the boundary of V, which is the union of the rim of the cylinder and the two space-like hypersurfaces. And the bulk in V, so the interior of V, is foliated by our sigma t hypersurfaces. But here I'm only looking at a segment of each sigma t hypersurface, and I have boundary, therefore each of those sigma t's now have boundary, which I'll call st, st being, well, something that actually foliates the rim of my cylinder. So that's what I was talking about. We're foliating the interior with sigma t in exactly the same way I constructed it there. But now because we have a finite spatial domain, each sigma t now will have boundary, and the boundary is going to be st, it's going to be a closed two-dimensional surface, closed three-dimensional surface. And, closed two-dimensional surface, that's a 3D surface, that's a closed two-dimensional surface. And we have one st per instant of time, and therefore we have foliation of the full cylinder, the rim of the cylinder, the outside of the cylinder, by those hypersurfaces st. And the rim of the cylinder, the closed cylinder, I'll call B. So that's the spatial boundary of my four-dimensional domain. So essentially, just to make the notation clear, I have a boundary that's going to be formed from the union of sigma 1, sigma 2, and B. And we have B foliated by sigma t, and we have B foliated by st. And the last thing I have to tell you is that st is actually the boundary of each surface sigma t. So that's just a refinement of the construction we had before. And what I want to do now is to introduce a little bit of details into all of this, because we're going to deal with the foliation, but we're also going to be dealing with the embedding of all of the lower dimensional surfaces into the higher dimensional manifolds. And lots of ways you can look at this. There's the embedding of sigma t into the four-dimensional manifold, and that, you know, comes with the usual notions of intrinsic coordinates, intrinsic metric, intrinsic curvature, extrinsic metric, extrinsic curvature, and all of these things. There's the foliation of st in each hypersurface sigma t. So we can consider st to be a surface in the three-dimensional manifold sigma t. And we can look at st as being embedded in that three-dimensional manifold, and we can, you know, redo all of that. There's going to be intrinsic coordinates in st. There's going to be an induced intrinsic metric on st. There's going to be an extrinsic curvature that's going to be describing the embedding of st in sigma t. And all of those notions that we know and, you know, discussed before are applicable in this context as well. But then there are all sorts of other things you can do. You can look at embedding st instead of embedding it directly, instead of embedding it in sigma t. You can look at this two-dimensional surface and embed it directly in space-time. And we're going to look at that too, and there's going to be some nice relationships between, you know, embedding it directly versus embedding it first in here and then embedding sigma t itself in four-dimensional space-time. There's the issue of embedding B as the hypersurface in the four-dimensional space-time manifold. And essentially, in order to do everything that needs to be done to the gravitational Hamiltonian, I need to look at all the aspects, all of those embeddings, and you know, just work it out fully. And we've done, you know, all of that we've done before, so I'm going to be talking about induced metrics and extrinsic curvatures, things like that. So it's all a repetition of what we've done before, but I just need to introduce a notation that's going to be specific to each particular embedding that I want to talk about here. So that's where it gets a that's a little bit detailed, that we have to keep the notation straight, and so on. So you'll have to bear with me. We have to do that carefully, and you'll see why we need to do this carefully when we proceed a little bit later. Okay. So I'll try to write this a little bit compactly so we can actually keep the information in one place. So first of all, let me, so something that's very familiar. So let's take sigma t and embed it in V, or in the, full four-dimensional space-time manifold. That's going to be my notation for the space-time manifold. So so we have defining relations for sigma t. We have parametric relations for sigma t. We have tangent vectors in sigma t. And we have normal vectors on sigma t. And all of those things are familiar, and we've talked about all of that before. The tangent vectors give us the induced metric. And the normal vector gives us an extensive curvature. And the last thing that you can write down is completeness relations for the metric. We can express the full space-time metric evaluated on sigma t in terms of a normal direction and a tangential direction. And those are all equations that we've seen before. So all of that's familiar. So, okay, let's do ST embedded in sigma t. Well, it's exactly the same thing, except that now my manifold is three-dimensional hypersurface. I call it sigma t. And my, my surface in that three-dimensional manifold is ST, and it's a two-dimensional surface. So what we need to do is to just repeat all the steps and introduce, here specific notions of, all of those things. So so when I look at ST as the boundary of sigma t, there would be some defining relations for that surface. So I can say, for example, that there's going to be some function phi of the space coordinates that will be constant on ST. So we've seen that before. There's going to be also a bunch of parametric relations that will express the three-dimensional coordinates YA in terms of intrinsic coordinates on that two-dimensional boundary. And here I'll just call those intrinsic coordinates, that's my standard notation, theta A. Because it's a closed surface, I can think of theta 1 and theta 2 as being angular coordinates on that closed surface, but they don't need to be angular coordinates. I'll just use that notation anyway. So those are the coordinates in the embedding. This is those are the coordinates in the in boundary itself. We have tangent vectors on ST, and I'm just going to adapt the notation in a way it makes sense. I'm going to take partial derivatives of YA with respect to the intrinsic coordinates, and that would be a notion of tangent vectors on ST, vectors being defined, in a three-dimensional sense, because I'm working on a hypersurface sigma t. And we have normal vector. The normal vector is going to be R A, so that's going to be my notation for the normal vector to each ST surface. So N is the vector that points normal to each sigma t. And R is a vector that points normal to each sigma t. So it's a normal vector to each sigma t on the boundary B. I won't write down the definition for that, but obviously it's going to be related to greatness, the defining relation, but I might as well say that. We're going to have introduced metric on ST. I'll call it sigma AB. And sigma AB is going to be, well, the metric in three-dimensional space projected down to each two-dimensional surface. So we're just importing exactly the same, the same relations. We're just working one dimension down. There's going to be an extrinsic curvature that describes the embedding of ST within each sigma T. And this, so this was uppercase K. I'm going to try to distinguish what is uppercase from what is lowercase. This is lowercase K carrying the indices uppercase A and uppercase B. And that's defined to be the covariant derivative of the vector R. But now I'm using the notion of covariant derivative that's specific to the hypersurface. It's the three-dimensional covariant derivative that's going to be compatible with the three-dimensional metric HP. And that is projected down onto the two-dimensional surface. So that's the extrinsic curvature. And then we have completeness relations that are written in more or less the same way, involving the normal direction and involving the tangential directions this way. And that's, you know, a full specification of all the aspects of embedding ST in sigma T. And this we do it repeatedly for each ST corresponding to each sigma T in our 3 plus 1 decomposition. All right. Well, let me do this again, but now slightly differently. I'm going to embed ST directly in the four-dimensional map. Here we go from four dimensions down to two dimensions, but everything is more or less the same. So we can repeat the entire story, but now we have to make our computation, adapted to this new context. Okay, well, if we go from the four-dimensional manifold to a two-dimensional surface, well, we can do that again by specifying a defined relation for the two-dimensional surface. So there's going to be some other scalar function, let's call it psi, that will now depend on space-time coordinates that's going to be a constant on ST. And there's going to be embedding, parametric relations of the sort, except that now I'm going from, it's a parametric description that I do directly from four dimensions down to two dimensions. So my parametric curves are to be expressed in space-time coordinates, and they're going to involve the intrinsic coordinates on ST. But if you would like to know what that is, well, one option would be to say, well, let's construct this parametric description by plugging that into here. And it's got to work, right? Because, you can embed ST in the full space-time manifold if you first embed in sigma T and then embed sigma T in the space-time manifold. So mathematically, if you have those equations that tell you where sigma T is, and those equations that tell you where ST is in sigma T, you can plug that into here mathematically and get the description of sigma T directly in space-time. In other words, this function that I'm constructing here is the one that I get mathematically by plugging those embedding relations into those embedding relations. And here I essentially merge this together and I get the relation directly. Okay, I have tangent vectors, but now will become space-time tangent vectors, which will be obtained by taking derivatives of my space-time coordinates with respect to the intrinsic coordinates. And that I can express by, either by taking the derivatives directly or applying the chain rule here. And if I apply the chain rule here, I first differentiate with respect to YA, and then differentiate YA with respect to theta A. And essentially what I can do is to write those tangent vectors in terms of a product of tangent vectors and see how the notation takes care of itself. Here we have tangent vectors in sigma t. Here we have tangent vectors in st as viewed from sigma t. We multiply them together, all the partial derivatives take care of themselves, and we get the space time vectors that are tangent to ST. So here you have to keep all the different letters straight. We have alpha, A, capital A. All right, we have normal vector. That's going to be our alpha, that's going to be given, you know, in terms of gradients of the differential function. I can express it like this, but probably you will be too surprised if I tell you that the tangent vector viewed in space-time is going to be the tangent vector viewed in three-dimensional space multiplied by the appropriate tangent vectors. So here I take the spatial vector and I push it forward in space-time using the tangent vectors. And, you know, those vectors have to agree in direction and magnitude, so I can immediately write down this relationship between the vector I get here versus the vector I got in the previous step. Okay, well, again, we could get the induced metric directly from the space-time metric by involving the tangent vectors in space-time. But given that I can express each one of these in terms of a product of tangent vectors, what I'll end up with is, well, exactly the same expression I got over here. So this induced metric, of course, that I get directly by embedding ST in space-time has to be compatible with the one I got by going the two-step way, where I first embed sigma t, then embed sigma t in directly in M. So if you go through the steps, you have g alpha beta, alpha, A, EA, too many A's. So you can express each one of them in terms of a product. Then you can group things together and you get G alpha beta multiplying the spatial three-dimensional tangent vectors that gives you H, A, B that multiplies A, EA, EB, B. And we get exactly the same induced metric that we constructed in the second step. So everything, of course, has to be nicely compatible. And okay, well, you can proceed like this. So obviously, the extrinsic curvature will be, well, exactly the same thing. So so I won't write this step. It's not necessary here. And we have completeness relations. And here I'll just write down the answer. So by decomposing the full space-time metric evaluated in ST and combining those two steps, well, we get the decomposition of the metric in terms of a normal to ST part and then a normal to B part and then a tangential part. So essentially what I'm doing here is to just plug that into here, and by combining RA with the tangent vectors, I'm getting R alpha, and here also I'm doing the same thing, and this is the end result. Okay, well, we're not quite done yet. Where should I go? Now I want to talk about B. Yeah. So the last step, I need two extra steps before we can return to the Hamiltonian. What I want to do now is to embed B in space-time. Well, we just follow the recipe, but now make sure that we keep the notation specific. B is going to have a set of defining relations. So let's see, I'm running out of function names. So let's call it F alpha equals to a constant. Those would be the defining relations of B in space-time. We have also parametric relations that tell us what curves in B are doing when we view them from curved space-time. And what I want to introduce here is a set of coordinates that will be intrinsic to B. And for the time being, I'll keep that coordinate system on B general. And later on, I'll connect that coordinate system to T and theta A. That would be the last step where I actually foliate B with STs. But I'm not going to do that just yet. I'll just say that the parametric relations that define B or curves in B are to be defined in terms of a new set of intrinsic coordinates that I'll call Z_i. And I is going to be my index that's going to be specific to B. So YA was specific to sigma T, theta A was specific to ST, and now Z_i is going to be specific to B. So we have the embedding relation, so we're going to have a bunch of tangent vectors on B, which are going to be partial derivatives of the space-time coordinates with respect to each z. We have normal vector, which has to be the same normal vector as we had in each st, right? So I'm not going to distinguish the notation. It's got to be the same normal. Because if you're normal to ST, you're automatically normal to B, and there can be only one unit normal vector on B, and it's got to agree with the one constructed before. And basically, the conclusion is that, well, this function F must be pretty much the same as the function psi in order for everything to be consistent, but that's not worth too much about that. So the normal vector R alpha is going to be given in terms of a derivative with respect to S. And you know, after normalization, we know that this R alpha will be exactly the same as the previous R alpha. Okay, we're going to have an induced metric on B. I'll call it gamma ij. Gamma ij is going to be the space-time metric projecting down to the Hadamard surface. Again, following the usual recipe. We're going to have extrinsic curvature on B. And I've already used uppercase K and lowercase K, so now I'm going to make up a curly K quantity. So I'm pretty bad with curly letters, so you know that's my attempt to write curly K. And it's going to be a Kij quantity that we get by taking derivatives of the normal vector and projecting this down onto the hypersurface. And then we have completeness relations. If we evaluate the inverse metric on B, we can break it down into normal components and tangential components in this way. So, you know, it's four times the same thing, but it's a little bit different each time, and the notation has to be specific to each case. And we have to keep the notation straight. And later on, we'll involve all of that in nice, you know, construction of the gravitational Hamiltonian. The last step we need to do before we can really move on is to think of B as a foliate, you know, as being foliated by all of my ST surfaces. So it's clear that, you know, it's already implicit in the construction that given that sigma t is foliating V, given that ST is the boundary to each sigma t, and given that V is the boundary, you know, the collective boundary, that we have automatically a foliation of V into ST surfaces. And given that we're using time in the bulk, you know, the t chord in the bulk, and given that we're using theta a coordinates on each st, it would seem to make sense to use t theta a coordinates on b and just make this choice. So instead of keeping zi as an arbitrary coordinate system on b, we might as well specialize it and consolidate the whole thing by specializing zi to be t at theta a. The only thing that we're missing is the connection between theta here and theta a there and theta a up here and so on. So we need to specify how a coordinate system on one ST surface will actually be mapped to coordinates, you know, either in the past or in the future. And that's where we're going to introduce a new network of curves that's going to be running along b and will, you know, take care of producing this mapping. So that's the last step that I need to do. And here I can, I can choose to be, a little bit simpler. I don't need, in this case, all the generality that I need to have in the bulk. I'll do something that's a little bit simpler from what I have to do in the bulk. So let's think of the foliation of V by ST. The main missing piece that we have so far is the mapping between an ST boundary, so the coordinates that I would use here, to the coordinates that I would use up here on an ST prime boundary. So this is a piece of B, and we have section ST of it, and then we have another section ST prime of it. And the idea is that, you know, if I say that this point on ST has coordinates theta A, how do I relate the coordinates here to coordinates up here? Well, I do it in exactly the same way we did it before. We're going to run a curve, a congruence along B, that's going to map coordinates here to coordinates there. And those curves are going to be curves of constant theta A coordinates. In the bulk, I insisted that I didn't want to assume anything about the curves. Here, I don't have, to have that much generality. I'm going to be happy to say that the curves are here chosen to be orthogonal to the boundary, to ST. So those are curves theta A, and curves of constant theta A are chosen to intersect ST, each one orthogonal. And the other thing that I'm going to do is to parameterize that by t the same way that I parameterized the other curves by t. We can do that. So those curves of constant theta A intersect this orthogonally, and they are parameterized. By t. So that means that here, the tangent vector to each curve is going to be in the direction of n, the normal vector, because the normal vector to each sigma t is going to be also normal to st in the time-like direction. And given that those curves are in the normal direction, it's got to be true that the tangent vector to each curve has to be in the direction of n. And then, you know, it's only a matter of figuring out how, the normalization enters it. So I'll just give you the answer. I'll tell you that the normal vector, the tangent vector to each curve, is in fact given by n times the Laplace function times the normal vector. And you can just check that this is compatible with all the choices that we made. In particular, it's compatible with the definition of the Laplace through this relationship here. So if you didn't have n here, you would have, you know, problems with making sure that this is a normalized vector and so on. All right. So we have that. We're going to make the choice zi is going to be selected to be the coordinates t and sigma a. We're going to make that choice. We can make that choice. We might as well make this choice. And what we're going to get then for displacements on B, we're going to get BS, dx alpha expressed in terms of, so we're going to get partial derivatives with respect to t that will give us the displacement in the normal direction. And then we're going to have partial derivatives with respect to the theta a coordinates that will give us displacements in the tangential directions. So we have breakdown of delta x a into a normal component and tangential component that I can write down like this. And each piece, so each direction is orthogonal to the others. So this direction is orthogonal to the tangential directions. So that when I write down the expression for the induced metric on B, well, I'm going to get the usual minus n squared dt squared plus the purely tangential displacements. And I'd have, in this case, a shift vector because that restriction that I imposed that I have thought, you know, process. And, well, if I summarize, and as a, you know, the last consequence of this that I care to extract is the fact that, well, the metric determinant, so the metric gamma ij now takes this explicit form. And the determinant of that metric, well, it's going to be given by the lattice multiplying the two-dimensional, the determinant of the two-dimensional metric. Right? So, so having made this choice, then the three-dimensional metric gamma ij takes this explicit form. And when you talk to the determinant, well, you get, you know, one factor coming from here and the rest of it coming from the purely two-dimensional entry. And that's the expression you get. All right. Well, now we're done. So now we can get, you know, get to the real business of constructing the gravitational Hamiltonian. All of the necessary geometrical elements are in place. And there's nothing very hard about this, but, you know, you need all of those details. Elements in order to proceed with the work. So let's see. So I have about 20 minutes left. I'll try to do a little bit of that before we have to break. And the reason why I want to proceed now and try to get someplace because, you know, I don't want to rewrite all of this down this afternoon. So I want to use as much of that as possible before we lose the information. Okay. So let's see. Probably I can slide this up and slide this up and work below. Okay, so we want to calculate the gravitational Hamiltonian. So we're going to start from the Lagrangian. We're going to start from the action. And we're going to, you know, rewrite the action in terms of 3 + 1 variables. That's the first step that we need to do. And then we'll, you know, define what is the time derivative, and then we'll be able to construct the canonical momentum, and then we'll be able to construct the gravitational Hamiltonian. So there's a lot of steps that go into that, and we just need to go through all of that. Okay. And we're going to have to, you know, worry about the boundary term. So returning to this picture over here, there's a slight issue of sign that needs to be cleared up. The normal vector to sigma 2 is the one that points toward the future. The normal vector to sigma 1 is also the one that points toward the future. The outward normal to delta v is going to be pointing in the outward direction here, the outward direction there. But it's going to be pointing in the outward direction here, which means that it's going to be pointing in the opposite direction for this normal vector. So when handling sigma 1, when dealing with sigma 1, we have to remember that when we use Gauss's theorem, the outward we have to deal with the outward normal vector. And there's going to be a distinction of sign between this normal vector and the outward normal vector to delta v. The way I deal with that in the book is to just insert a minus sign over here, which doesn't mean anything mathematically, but is there to remind us that that there's this issue of you know, of directions of normal. So let's keep that in mind because it's important. Gravitational action. Well, the gravitational action, there's a factor of 16 pi that will come along for the ride. There's a bulk term that that's an integral over delta, over the domain V. We have four-dimensional Ricci tensor, and we have a four-dimensional element, volume element, and then we have the boundary term that is going to be expressed as an integral over delta V. But now I want to break down this integral into, you know, V, into sigma 2, into sigma 1. And I want to remember that the sign of the integral depends on whether the boundary is space-like or time-like. I don't want to write an expression for delta V because, you know, the expression that I wrote down before involved, you know, an integral over delta V as opposed to a three-dimensional integral. There was an epsilon in it, and then there was a k, and there was a root g, a root h, and a d3y. Well, the point is that I don't want to write this down because that notation is specific to sigma t. It's only on sigma t that I'm using uppercase k as the expression for, as the notation for the extensive curvature. It's only on sigma t that I'm using ya as intrinsic coordinate. So I just want to write this in more precise form by breaking down the total delta v integral into three separate pieces. And here they are. There's going to be an integral over sigma 2 that will come with a minus sign because sigma 2 is a space-like surface and normal is time-like. It comes with a minus sign, it comes with a factor of 2, and the extrinsic curvature on sigma 2 is the extrinsic curvature on each sigma t hypersurface, and that's the k that I've introduced up there. And then we integrate this over root h, and we integrate this over d3y. Then there's going to be an integral over sigma 1. And normally, it would also come with a minus sign because it's also a space-like surface and because it's normal is also time-like. But here, we have to remember about the issue of the outward normal and all of that. And we have to, in fact, take the opposite sign. So here, it's going to be a plus sign, a factor of 2. And an integral over sigma 1 involving the same extrinsic curvature and the same volume element. And again, the plus sign has to do with the fact that in the usual notation, I'm really referring to the outward normal. Here, I'm referring to the one that points in the opposite direction. And finally, there's the piece over B. The piece over B also comes with a plus sign. But this time, that has to do with the fact that this this surface is time-like, the normal is space-like, and the appropriate sign in this case is positive. And here, the intrinsic curvature that I define for B is this curly K thing. That's the curly K, and the volume element is the gamma metric, and the volume element, the coordinate volume element, is defined in terms of the z coordinates, which, you know, at the later state will become t and theta a. So that's the volume action. That's the gravitational action, and we have to, you know, keep all the boundary terms there. They're all very important. But what I want to do, of course, is to rewrite all of this, especially the bulk term, into a 3 plus 1 form. And what I need to do is to break down the four-dimensional Ricci tensor into quantities that live on each hypersurface. And you'll remember that we've dealt with that before. We can express the four-dimensional Ricci scalar in terms of the three-dimensional Ricci scalar and square terms in the extrinsic curvature. Those are, you know, We dealt with that, I think last week maybe or 2 weeks before. Those are the gas cadets type equations. And we can also break down this volume element into, I've lost that information, but, express that in terms of the TYA coordinates and use the lattice here and the three-dimensional metric to write this down. So in V, we have an expression for four-dimensional Ricci scalar in terms of three-dimensional Ricci scalar. And here, to keep the notation straight, I'll put 3 on top. And if you go back to your notes, you'll see that, well, there are terms here that involve the square of the extrinsic curvature on sigma t, the square of its trace. And if you go back to your notes, you'll find that we had an expression for the rest of it expressed in terms of double time derivatives, second time derivatives of the metric. And that's when we were working in terms of Gaussian norm coordinates, and we had simple expressions for these things. What I didn't do at the time is to re-express this in more covariant form. And I'll just do it here. I go through that derivation in notes, so maybe you've encountered that. But the rest of it, I won't express it in the same form we used to have before. I'll express it in terms of covariant quantities, and the rest of it. Involves second derivatives of the normal vector. That's what we get by translating the second derivatives of the metric tensor with time into more covariant language. So you'll have to take my word that this is really the appropriate expression, or you can proceed from what we had before and derive that this is really the appropriate expression for the Ricci tensor. And what's interesting is that the rest of the stuff here is actually a pure divergence. And it's important that it's a pure divergence. And in fact, what we'll do is to keep this as volume integral, but this using Gauss's theorem, we're going to push to the boundary. And that's going to turn out to be rather interesting because, when we're done with that calculation, we're going to see that this contribution from the boundary, distribution from the volume integral that is now being pushed on the boundary will cancel out this, will cancel out that, and will make an extra contribution to this. So in the end, the volume term in the action after the 3 plus 1 decomposition will get rid of the sigma 1 and sigma 2 integrals. Those will disappear. And the only thing that's going to remain is a boundary integral that will be, this plus an extra contribution that we'll need to work out. And in the end, we'll end up with a rather neat interpretation for this. It's going to be expressed in terms of the little k extrinsic curvature. What that means is that the full boundary integral here will involve the intrinsic curvature of st embedded in sigma t. And the bulk term will be an integral involving those two-dimensional extrinsic curvatures. So again, there's some detailed work that can go into that, and what I'm thinking is that probably I'll have to sacrifice all that detailed information while you have saved on your in your notes. But now is probably a good time to stop, and I'll come back to that this afternoon, and we'll go through the rest of the calculation. So there is some work involved here. It has to be careful, detailed work, but all the steps I think. Aren't difficult, so we just have to be patient and deal with them. But in the end, we'll end up with the rather neat expression for the gravitational action that then will be ready for insertion into the procedure to obtain the Hamiltonian. And at that stage, we'll have to do a little, more detailed work. But I think by the end of the afternoon, we'll probably have our expression for the gravitational Hamiltonian. At least that's my ambition. Okay. So any questions about that? Okay, so let's break lunch, and I'll see you in the afternoon.